I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
I think we should start in 1989.
Okay.
In the spirit of the book, we should have a little date in the corner, 1989. So how did you get to... being Raw and part of that group of artists, meeting Art Spiegelman, Francois Mouly. Can you give us a bit of background on that?
Okay. 1989. Well, I guess it's really 1988. I was, I was already a big fan of Raw. Raw was just a big, beautiful format comic that Art Spiegelman made that I just was, you know, crazy about. But I hadn't done any comics at that point. What was I doing? I was pasting up drawings on the street. That's what I did. When I first moved to New York, I was doing these drawings, and I would just be these kind of like ripped stencil drawings that I would write a funny little phrase around, and then I would glue them up. And it was my response to graffiti. I was out just doing this as I was pasting up posters for my band at the time. I was pasting up these drawings.
So, was there a narrative going on in
there? There was a loose narrative. There was a character called Ixnay, which was like a shadow character, and that was my kind of alter ego. So I was doing that. I was doing graphics for the band. I was doing all the posters for the band and the record sleeves. I went to see a lecture that Art Spiegelman had done. And my takeaway from that was, he showed like the history of comics. And he was also, you know, showing the mechanics of how comics work. And that is the big takeaway from me, was the fact that comics... they're essentially diagrams. And when I came home, I just moved into an apartment, and I was staring at the corner of the room, and I was thinking, oh, I can make a story and use the corner of the room as a dividing line, and I could make the past go, like have half the frame, a split screen, and have half the frame going into the past and the other half going into the future. And then a friend showed me his computer with the Windows program. And when I saw the Windows program and all those windows, I thought, oh, I can do multiple views of time. So that was the big eureka moment.
And were there any comics in your childhood or anything that you sort of remembered back to or re-associated yourself with when you realized you were going to do a comic as well?
You know, I was aware of comics like Crazy Cat and Popeye and... You know, but it wasn't until, I guess I was on this trajectory of doing artwork mostly. But I really wasn't into the comic scene. My brothers were into superhero comics and things. But it must have been the Raw magazine that really, you know, showed me a way that got me excited about doing something. But, you know, there was a review in Harper's last month that was referring to the Robert Crumb strip that was Crossroads of America. Mm-hmm. Do you know this one? I don't know if everyone knows this, but it shows just, it's just a corner of a typical American city. And then you start to see, the city builds up and you're just seeing a change over time. And so I know I must have seen that because I was a fan of some of the, well, I'm definitely a fan of Crumb.
Yeah.
And he also did one of a strip of Mr. Natural, that Mr. Natural rolls out his meditation mat, and he's in the desert, and he's meditating, and then the city builds up around him, and then eventually it crumbles down, and then he's back to being in the desert, and he rolls up his mat. So I know I saw that too. Yeah. I know it. So that must have been bouncing
feeling
around. It must have been bouncing around.
A demonstration of time,
right?
Changing. So, so when it came to doing the story,
mm-hmm.
we have this very, very strict format of looking into a corner of a room, and then watching pieces of time, pieces of motion, people talking across time, across years, across decades. Where did that start to come from?
Well,
you mentioned a couple, but
yeah.
when did it start to crystallize to this very tight corner of a room format?
Well, it seems I've been seeing a pattern with the way I work is like I come up with a structure first, and then it seems like I'm always hanging things on top of the structure. So having this situation on this room, I now had to fill it full of characters. And this is pre-internet days, so the only source or the main source I had was my family photos. Mm. So, you know, to go back. And actually, that was another thing I meant to mention was that my father took lots of photos of us. Well, every year he took a family photo in the same exact place. And so, and I put some of them into the book. So for those, I'm just going to, this is just paging through the book right now. And what I thought I would do is just go to show that one little view of my family photos, which I put into the book.
So a lot of the images, a lot of the drawings to me look photographed. They look like there was definitely a photograph there at the origin of the drawing.
Yes, everything is based on photos.
Here's
the little family group. Here I am.
Yeah.
I'm in the lower left over there.
Okay.
And then I'm going to have to.
And there's a few years of those. Was this a yearly event gathering for the
family photo?
Yes, a yearly event. There I am, devolving into some of that. Family source was the main thing.
Is this a true story?
Which one? The one?
The joke.
This joke?
The guy dying with laughter, literally, almost.
The beginning, for those who don't know the book, there's a really dumb joke at the beginning of the book where it's a guy calls his doctor and for some test results, and then the doctor says, I have some good news and some bad news. And he says, okay, well, tell me the good news. He says, the good news is you have 24 hours to live. And he says, that's the good news. What's the bad news? And he says, I should have told you yesterday. So that's the dumb joke. But my cousin...
A joke about time, though.
Right, a joke about time. But my cousin told me that it happened to someone he knows, that they told that joke and somebody fell over dead at the end of the joke. And I couldn't believe it myself. So I was like, that's going...
Straight in.
Look. Yeah. So anyway, that's how the book starts.
Okay.
And...
It occurred to me when I was looking at it, it's almost like you were coming at memories from almost arbitrary ideas. I remember somebody told me if you want to remember your life when you were 20, when you were 10, whatever, come at it from a funny position, like what shoes you were wearing or something like that, and you start to remember things from an unusual angle, and it all starts to come back to you in an unusual way. I wonder, because there are several things in here, like the sun and like animals, and it's almost like you'd listed how many different ways can I put these through time in different iterations through time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a way that you were attacking it?
I do. I was making hundreds of lists and just trying to hit these points that I knew that were universal for everyone. You know, there's themes like loss. There's a section of loss where people are losing, you know, their keys and their wallets and their minds, and you know, it's just everyone's losing something. Then there's another part where people are, you know, misunderstanding each other. So I was grouping things under these kinds of things, and then trying to hit all those kind of points of like going, you know, birthdays, weddings, all these things. I was thinking they were common, and it was when I was pulling together the research for the book version, I came across, there was a few things. I was I got a fellowship at the New York Public Library, and it's a kind of a great thing called the Coleman Center, and it's something usually just it's a literary fellowship, but they do take on a few visual artists, and I was lucky enough to get one of those. So I was able to do a lot of research there about the actual location of where I grew up. Because in the first book, I didn't say anything of where it was. I wanted it to be like in every place. When I really had to dig into, for the book version, you know, I went back and I read all these newspapers from my hometown, and I just, you know, was digging, finding photo archives. They have some great collections of people's scrapbooks of photos, and you know, I met some collector who collects vernacular photography, and I was going through all his photos, and that's one thing that I found, like, you start to look at family photos, they all start looking alike. There's everyone has these same pivotal events, you know. It's like, you know, the graduation pictures and the, you know, the holidays, and so it starts to have these, you know, they all look the same.
And also photographs from a particular era all share certain things. They share the certain attitude to posing for a photograph, the way they're cropped.
Well, I was really the clothes, obviously, that they're wearing. I mean, it's really going out of my way to find those casual moments of people just doing a little gesture, something that wasn't posed. I was really going for that. Uh-huh. That was really what, you know, there's some funny little moments like, well, let me see if I can find something quickly here. Like, my father...
There's an important bit of history here.
Oh,
a moment of American history.
Yeah, we're going to have to keep jumping around the way the book works. We're going to have to, as we do this, because there's no other way to talk about this.
But that sort of specifies that this is taking place in New Jersey. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I had to actually eventually commit to...
Commit to a place.
But
in 300 pages, you have to commit to it.
But I didn't want to mention the place even in interviews. I felt a little weird about it because it was kind of like, you know, then otherwise then people keep saying, oh, it's a history of this town. And it's not a history of this town. I mean, there are some historic moments, but it's not really. So were you going to start talking about the place across the street? Was that what the...
Well, no, I mean, because you mentioned trying to make it in every place, but this was the bit that seemed to really, you know, it tied it to a place.
Yes.
There's a very particular bit of history with William Franklin, Ben's son.
Yes.
Illegitimate son.
This building across the street, I hope you can all see that over there. It's actually, I actually tucked it over to the side because I was kind of de-emphasizing the story because of the Franklin connection. I didn't want him to be suddenly like, he's like a rock star history figure, and I didn't want that to take over the book. So, but if you walked out my front door, you would smack that dab directly across the street is this building that is huge. And I always knew that Franklin was associated with it somehow. But I didn't really know until I started really digging that it was his son's house. And Ben Franklin had this illegitimate child that he raised himself. He was a single parent, raised this kid, and they were really, really close, and they did all those electrical experiments together, like, you know, those famous things where you see Franklin out there with the kite and the key. It's really William Franklin out there running around in the rain, and Ben is in the house just like waving, you know, like, but they were really close, and then they split politically as he grew older, and he remained he was a loyalist, and Ben came to London to try to get us, you know, to negotiate us out of the revolution.
Yeah, and became a terrorist.
Right, and he went back to convince his son that he was on the wrong side of history. But there's even strange things even with that. That when I started digging, I would come up with this stuff that I couldn't really use for the book without too much explanation. Like, okay, Benjamin Franklin had a bastard son. He had a bastard son. It's like Benjamin Franklin took his grandson to London, and then when he went to visit his son, he brought his grandson along with him. His grandson was 15 years old at the time. And the last time Benjamin Franklin was in the town, he was 15 years old, mm-hmm. when he was passing through on his way to Philadelphia before he becomes a big famous guy. So I'm seeing these like patterns. But it just seemed like, okay, this is not the Benjamin Franklin story, so I don't want to get into that. I want to just reduce it to just a little argument of a father and a son that's happening across the street. So I didn't want to make it a big deal.
Okay,
big
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make it a big deal.
I'm sorry.
I like that the story stops in these little moments, stops in these places, and implies a whole depth of stuff beyond and after it. Right. And you're free to go and explore. I spent some happy time exploring the lives of William Franklin and Ben Franklin.
Okay, well, one thing I did want to point out was lots of the photos. Oh, well, this is my... This right here, this is a picture of my dad and my sister. And there's a little sequence here where he just kisses her. And I'll blow that up just so people... And my dad was always behind the camera. But I caught this little glimpse of him. It was at the end of a Super 8 film. Super 8 films, for those who don't know that old technology, these little tiny films. And the film is sputtering out of the, you know, projector, and I see these last couple frames where he kisses my sister. And it was such a nice little moment that I was able to, and I feel like by painting each frame and just make it in, you know, slowing down the motion, it made it, you know, stronger to slow it down.
But doesn't that, it functions very much like memory. If you were trying to remember that afternoon,
right,
it would, in your mind, it would focus on that little moment.
Right. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, when you come away from this talk tonight, I don't know what you're gonna retain. But it's like, that's the kind of thing, like, I just had a conversation with a friend earlier, and I was trying to say, okay, now what was it? And you only see in your, at least this is how it works for me, I just see a few pictures, maybe a gesture somebody made, and, you know, a few key words. And if you're lucky, if you can remember that much of something. It's just amazing how fragmented we're. And I was wondering, well, why did I remember just those moments? Mm. And maybe I was in the now for only those moments. Mm. And maybe I was all over the place making connections in my head, thinking of, you know, because we're constantly flying through time. You know, on the way over here, I'm looking out the window and I'm seeing a place. I'm going, oh, the last time I was in London, I saw this. And, you know, you're just like either going forward or backward constantly.
I think it has something to do with the fact that you remember something if you've repeated it to yourself. So if we're all here this afternoon, this evening now, if there is one thing that's said or one little gesture or one something, and you remember it in 10 minutes time and then in an hour's time, it kind of locks. And then that becomes the memory of this event. And it doesn't matter, it might become a bit of a photocopy of the memory, so it might change a bit.
Well, they say that too, that every time you remember something, you erode it
slightly.
And do you know, what's that thing called?
And it is true, it does change. If you can find proof of what happened, this is recorded somewhere, you'll come back in 5 years' time and go, actually, he didn't quite say that, it was something like, I've misremembered it.
Right. But I was suddenly thinking of that trick that they tell you when you're trying to remember something, like a long speech. What's the thing called, like, the palace of memory? Do you know what I'm talking about? I don't know if everybody...
Memory palace.
Yeah, the idea of, like, you think of a house, and somehow you think of all these really odd things that...
The stranger the image, the easier it is
Yeah. And I just think, well, so maybe this is a sort of a memory palace.
I was just going to point it that way. I love this, the little tumble.
Oh, that's my cousin.
In slow motion.
That's my cousin doing the headstand here.
Again, that really feels like memory to me.
Ah.
Those little pieces of time.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a couple of books about memory. And the first one I ended up just doing in still images and combinations of sort of texture, a bit of texture and a bit of a map and a bit of a still image. And then thought about it afterwards. Actually, no, I don't really remember that. I did another book and it was all little moments of time. Mm. Just little turns of the head or little... little bits of fragments of time, and they bleed off. They go a bit soft at the edges where I'm not sure what happened before, I'm not sure what happened afterwards, but during that moment, mm-hmm. you get a little tumble.
Right,
and that's what crystallizes the memory.
Well, I was trying to think, the other night I was talking with friends and we were trying to remember our very first memory, and I remembered before we moved to the house, I was we lived in an apartment, and the building was close enough to the building next door that my mom and the woman next door used to open their windows and just talk across the alley. And I remember the woman said, I have a little gift for your son. And she went off, and then she came back, and she took a little doll, and she threw it through the window, and this doll came tumbling in. And I think it's my very, very first memory, because I must have been 2, probably, you know? So, anyway, I thought I'd share it with you.
History of Christmas
trees.
The first one's a bit bedraggled and a bit wonky.
Well, you know, it was a real photo of a crazy looking Christmas tree, and I couldn't resist.
So is the family doing a bit better? You were able to get a more upright Christmas tree and a bit.
Well, it's not all. This is not a memoir. It's not exactly one to one memories. Okay. It's a real mix of. This is on the couch in the woman with the baby on the couch. That's me, as a baby. That's my mom. And next to her is my great grandmother holding my mom, and my sister Mary is holding her son Tim, and this is my aunt Rose, who had 11 children, and I felt that she should be on this page. As this was my salute to moms. I had the woman on the far right. It was just an image I found in a photo album in the garbage that I just loved the composition of it and just put her in there. But it's funny how, like, in my notes, I had this idea of having like a sea of moms and babies coming. I wanted to have this whole thing of this having this, you know, and it finally, I mean, this is how these things get distilled down. Like, my idea was to have like hundreds and hundreds of moms and babies coming. But,
so this is a list based on your photo album at home, really, just categorizing all those photos as
well,
okay, yeah. It's the mother spread.
The mother spread. But it's like, you know, there was a lot of ways of plotting the book. I had a timeline that went all the way around my studio. And then I would fill in little marks where I find something really that I really wanted to put in. I would mark it. But then eventually I started putting up all the pages and then cutting things out and rearranging things and trying to find the right, correct flow. So there's a lot of different ways of conducting it. Yeah. You know.
Oh, this is the interactive version.
Yes, it's a shame.
Even more complicated. Maybe. Of course, the history of this room is vast in time,
right.
the history of humans' interaction in it is a tiny little blip.
That's true.
And most of the time, you've got trees and forest and all that. I love right. the fact that they put forest on the walls.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. To remind themselves
right.
that they're only a little blip away from not being there anymore.
The Indians.
Relationship to the
Indians.
Indians that are there.
The
so you've got Delaware Indians, is that correct?
Well, they're called they were the Lenni Lenape tribe.
That's the language, isn't it?
Lenape
language.
Yeah, well, that's the official name of that. And they were like the grandfather tribe of the East Coast. And they were all in kind of New York, New Jersey area. And they were there for 11,000 years before the Dutch arrived.
Yeah.
And I read a lot of letters from the Dutch, like writing home about little stories and things. Because I was trying to find one of those little moments like the kid doing the headstand. I wanted something the equivalent
yeah.
in the Lenape. You know, it's like something small. I found this one little story where the guy said that they made this big kind of ceremony and they presented him with this little packet and they opened it up and it was just dirt in there. And the guy didn't know what to make of it. And he was like, you know, and so I put that in the book where it's mm-hmm. like this guy thinks, he says, is this a joke? You know, and it's like this, because there was all this kind of like miscommunication, lots of hand signals. I mean, that's the only way they could communicate was by pantomime.
Okay.
And so I kind of interlaced that with my father not hearing me, and he's, so that's a little moment of the misunderstanding moment where there's somebody doing a charades party in the background while the Indians are not being understood. And
I wanted to talk about music.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're a musician.
Right.
The book felt very musical to me. It felt structured like a piece of music. It felt like it's almost symphonic. It started slow and gentle and eased you into an empty room.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you say, there are these sequences where you get little categories of things that you're talking about, little moments of activity, of lots of, suddenly there is lots of sound and lots of melody and counterpoint and syncopation and all this stuff going on. And then it
right.
eased off again.
Right.
And it felt very much structured right. like piece of music. I was wondering if that's true, and if you listen to music, and if music was an inspiration in creating the book.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was one of the biggest difficulties I had with it being a non-linear story. I was really having trouble with the writing, and at first I thought, oh, maybe I need really long narrative threads to hold the viewer. And the longer I worked on it, the more I realized I'm getting further away from the original idea of what worked in the first version. So I started having to break those long threads. And I realized that the only way I could make it feel right was to think of it as music. And that's why I put up all the pages on my wall to try to see the flow of it. And I knew like it needed rests and it needed crescendos, and I finally figured that out. But it took a while for me to get there. And even like, when I was talking about making those lists, I was making lists. I was treating the language just as much as a collage as the images. The language is very much collaged in the same way, and sometimes I'm just listening to it. I mean, sometimes it's just about the sound of the words. There's a guy.
That's a particularly beautiful
spread. Thanks.
The silence of the forest, or the sound in the forest, actually, the sounds in the forest, are you can tell they're in her head. I mean, there's a real silence in the room, and yet. Silence of the forest. It reminded me of that, that old saying, if a tree falls in a forest, it just, I think it's a really, really beautiful
one. It's funny how they sometimes do feel like they're the memories of the people in the frame. Like it's somehow, like in this particular one, it does feel a little like that.
I think that's because we can't help but draw a story.
Right.
That's what our brains do.
Right.
Given two pictures, we find a story between them.
Right. That is true. This is a little moment of the end of the world happening on the TV there. I was reading about how at a certain point the sun is supposed to run out of energy, expand, and suck in all the planets, and supposedly that's the end of the Earth. And so I was actually going to do it as this big dramatic scene with burning walls and everything. And then I just thought, oh my God, like it's just so melodramatic. I just kept getting smaller and smaller and just becomes this little dot on the TV screen.
Yes.
And I think it was a better way. I've said it in other interviews, but it was my motto was to make the big things small and the small things big.
Okay.
And I thought that's kind of an example with the Benjamin Franklin story too, is just to, shrink that down, because I really wanted it to be about just little things like, someone touching someone, or it's just little moments,
Having said that, it's not a very happy ending for mankind in this story.
Well,
in the future,
because you don't see anybody.
The water rises pretty damn quickly.
Well, there was a friend of mine who's a climate scientist, and he showed me these projected maps, and you see that it's all going to be flooded at a certain point. And then I have there's a future moment where there's a tour guide. Showing the future.
Holographic
images. And then
A horrible radiation accident seems
to have occurred. It's because when I was working on the book, the Fukushima accident happened. So that was on my mind. And then there was the Sandy hurricane that wiped out all these houses in that same kind of, a little more south than where this takes place. But I just thought, okay, that's a possibility.
It's a possibility.
And then, I was also reading that in Chernobyl, I think it's 20,000 years that Chernobyl, the radiation will be back to a normal level. So that's why I made this huge jump to 20,000 years. But it's kind of like, there's like orchids and there's,
The hummingbirds.
The hummingbirds. And so, and there's a little creature in the background who, I don't know, he's some kind of mutation or something. And I just thought, it's not totally negative.
No.
There's still, just because you don't see any people doesn't necessarily mean that all life is gone.
Not at all.
And
evolution in action, that strange little creature in the background.
Yeah, there was something I wanted to show you that I found a photograph of a bear.
Okay. Actually, I was just going to come to that, because the animals play a really lovely... They have their own whole story going through here.
Well, yeah, the animals pop up all the time. But there was this one photograph I found of a bear, and the bear had... It was in a zoo, and I could have sworn it was in the London Zoo, but maybe I'm wrong. But it had lost all its hair. And it just looked like this strange prehistoric creature, because you just saw these folds in its skin, and it didn't look like any recognizable animal that you could see. And so I thought, okay, maybe this is the bear of the future, where it's like,
they've evolved that way.
They've evolved where they don't have any hair.
Yeah.
So I was saving that image, and I was going to say, okay. Then I was doing the research about the Lenape Indians, And I found out that they had this myth bear that was this hairless bear. So I was like, oh, great. So now he can be Bear of the Past and Bear of the Future simultaneously. So I put them both. There's both those images.
And in the middle, the boy in the bear suit.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I put that as another, like, there's all these echoes.
Yes.
And rhyming, visual rhyming, yeah, things happening. That's part of the way life works.
Yes. And a nice
it
moment
to me all the time.
And a nice moment with a couple looking at a stag head mounted on the wall saying, don't like it.
Right.
I like that
right.
one as well. The animals have their own life. I really love
right.
that.
This image here, this is a future image. This, these guys playing with the this game.
Yeah.
This actually came to me from a dream I had. There was I was dreaming, actually when I was looking at all these photographs from my house, I was dreaming a lot about the actual house. And in this dream, I was looking out the window and I saw my sister, but it was like a teenage version of my sister. And I opened the window and stuck my head out to yell to her, and there was all this wind going by, and suddenly all this hair in my face. And I had long hair when I was a kid, so when I woke up, I was like, oh, so I became younger when I stuck my head through the window. And then I used it in this little sequence with these guys playing with this virtual game here, because this guy sticks his head in, and you can see he becomes a younger version of himself.
Holographic game. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about a couple of artists that I thought might have influenced this a little bit. One of them is really reasonably obvious, Edward Hopper. There's,
yeah.
His paintings of looking into the corner of the room, and that sort of peace and absence of people.
Film, yeah.
Pictures about absence.
That's true.
I wondered if they played a part at all.
Sure. I mean, I was always a fan of Hopper. There was actually a strange connection that happened just when I was finishing the cover of the book. Okay, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. I did a cover that was kind of a collage, and I didn't know what to make of it. I was like, I knew it wasn't the exact right cover yet. And there's this guy, Peter Mendelsohn. I don't know if anybody knows him. He's a really great graphic. I mean, well, he does great jacket designs. And he has a big book that just came out last year of his designs. And he also wrote a book called What We See When We Read, which is really great, by the way. And so I didn't know Mendelsohn, but I wrote him an email and just said, you know, I'm working on this book, and can I drop by and show you the book? So it was just one of these amazing moments where I walk in, we're talking like maybe 30 seconds, I'm showing him the book, and he just takes a quick look at it, and he loves it, and then he goes, but this cover, it shouldn't be, this is wrong. He was like, this cover, I was glad he was completely honest with me. He just said, you shouldn't have on the cover the same thing that you have inside the book. And it was like he shot me between the eyes. Yeah. It was just like, you're absolutely right. This sounds perfectly reasonable. And then he said, okay, I'm just going to throw this out, but why don't you just put the outside of the house on the book? And I was like, you're brilliant. This is that's exactly what I need to do. And so I left the meeting and I was all excited. And then I painted, I don't know how many versions of this, trying to solve it. And I could not solve the problem. Every time I painted it, it looked like this like home magazine or something with this window. It just looked really terrible. And then I kept simplifying it and simplifying it. And then I put that dramatic shadow across. And I thought, okay, I'm getting closer. And this is the strange Hopper connection, which is really weird, was... there's a really famous Hopper painting called Sunday Morning. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's kind of a low red building, and the sun is hitting across the street, and there's nobody on the street, and it's just like this rectangular, desolate image with a strong shaft of light. It's so crazy. I'm like doing some research, looking for images and stuff, and then I see online there's an essay somebody wrote and says, that that painting was painted right on the corner of where I live. And so I was passing it every day, and I was taking photos when the sun was hitting at a certain angle. I'm taking photos of those windows, and then I find out, like, in his research, he found an old photograph that had the barber pole and the fire hydrant that lined up perfectly to the painting. So I was actually using that source without even realizing it. So anyway, So then I paint this, finally, the window with the dramatic light and this thing. And the word here is really big, and it's, I just keep making it smaller and smaller. And then I put it small, and I was like, okay, I think this is it. And I send it to Peter Mendelssohn, and he writes me back just one line. He says, close the curtain over the word, and then that puts the word inside the room. And I was like, oh, like, it was like so brilliant, you know. So I, every time I have, feel I have to give him his nod. So, yeah.
The only other one I wanted to quickly mention, I have no idea if you've seen this, but this is the only thing that I really thought of strongly when I was reading the book. It's a film by a guy called Zbigniew Rybczynski.
Yes,
it's
yes,
called
yes.
Tango.
Yes. This guy.
Well,
I don't know.
Made lots of films similar, cut up with a static camera and time moving.
Yeah,
but
I don't know.
Tango in particular.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody knows this guy. He went on to make some music videos and had a little moment where he was very, but he never made a feature film. He just made these short films. And I think it's Tango, is that the one with it's a room.
It's a room.
And there's like a kid walks by, throws a ball into the...
Ball comes in through the window. The kid comes in to retrieve it.
And then he crawls out again.
And then it pops back in.
Yeah. So he's a loop. The kid's a loop. And then all these other loops start happening. And somebody comes in and puts down a package. And then another person puts a ladder in.
Couples coming in making love on the bed. There's guys falling off ladders. The room is a chaos of little loops of people.
But it's pre-digital. It's pre-digital.
Yeah,
it must have cut out
the photos.
Yeah. It's a masterpiece. I think you can see it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And
then slowly empties out. Slowly one of them doesn't loop.
Right.
And then slowly empties out.
Right.
And the ball pops back in and the boy retrieves it and that's it.
Right.
Great film.
See.
Good.
I forgot about that.
Is it a Polish video game?
Yes.
Zbigniew Rybczynski is named.
Ariston, like appliances, they ripped it off for a TV advert.
Really?
Advertising for you.
I don't know what he's doing now, but I really.
Well, he's still working. He went to America, made some bigger budget, but kind of less interesting. But always stayed within the art video area, doing gallery exhibitions, but they were videos.
Mm.
Never went into narrative film. Okay, I think we're getting close to sort of question and answers, so think of questions.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Questions. Is there anything else we need to cover?
Well, there's probably...
We've done history, we've done animals.
Plenty. You know, one thing, when I was working on the book, I knew, going back into it, that I wanted to do an interactive version of it.
Yeah.
And for the last 2 years, I was giving a talk about my work, and there just happened to be a programmer in the audience. And the guy was just this brilliant guy who took the original strip, and he just made this little model of it. And he showed me how he could do it. And so we worked together closely over the last 2 years on this project. And so what you've been looking at so far is just...
There it is.
Oh, there's that bear.
I wonder what the hell that was. That is evolution having a bad day.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. The thing about this interactive version is we've been paging through it. Oh,
tell me who these guys are.
Guys having a fight. There's nothing.
Okay.
People fight.
Family members?
Could be.
I really like that spread. I love that spread.
Oh, with
different little moments in
insults. Sea of insults.
Little moments in sound. The one that got me was nerd.
Hmm.
Being in 1950.
Well,
because you associated so much with sort of recent use.
Right.
But it is 1950.
Well, this is one of the things I did.
Yeah.
Researching in the library.
Where was it first seen?
Yeah, I mean, finding the dictionaries, finding the first uses of these insults. Usually the translation version, there's 10 translations so far, and it's very funny to see how that's always worked out.
But was that important? But it was first used in Dr. Seuss. Was that?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Ah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
First
that.
Use of nerd.
Really?
The word nerd. Dr.
Seuss. He invented it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. I didn't know that. So the thing with this interactive version, what you've just been seeing now is just me flipping through pages of the book. But if you, the program is made so when you click the date in the upper left corner, it starts to reassemble the panels. So then you start to get random connections.
Is it random or is there a structure?
It's random.
It is random.
The more I've been playing with it, I've been seeing things like, and this is something, there's a constant talk between me and the programmer where we're improving, trying to find, like if there's, it is satisfying when you have a cluster that seems to go well together. So we are building certain things into the randomization. So sometimes it's more satisfying when you have, like, you know, you click on that deer head and then suddenly a deer shows up. And then so there are some connections.
Tendencies.
But that it doesn't happen every time. No. That's the important thing, is that it always surprises.
Yeah.
So, and also there's little bits of animation that are in here. And I'm hoping, actually, before I even show anything like that, like you can follow a thread just by clicking the frame. So you can just follow it like a wormhole of a story. And like in this particular story of the artist and the model, I wrote a really long narrative for that. And I cut it from the book because it slowed down the book. But I'm thinking about putting it back into the ebook version. But even then, it would be a surprise because it wouldn't happen every time.
Well, but this is kind of an infinite project, really, for you, isn't it? Because you've got these little moments. You've skipped a stone across the surface of this story, and below and above are an infinite number of stories you could tell.
In theory, I could be doing this forever. So yes. I don't want to be stuck into the room for the rest of my life. Here's another little example of the animation of the kind of, but I'm making
animation as well.
Just tiny, tiny little things. So when they happen, they feel really special when they do happen. So
and the cat was the star of the short story as well. So I'm glad he's back.
Well, you know, in the first version, he was a cat of the future, and now he's a cat of the past. So that's a strange thing. And also, he's walking in a different direction because of his place and time. Is that bear suit?
That's the bear suit.
See, there's a cluster of costumes, a costume cluster. That's a nice image. I like it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
And actually, there's a few things you don't see in the book because they're covered up by panels, you know? And so when this, you don't see this image here with, you don't see it fully.
So originally you did all the images clean and you've...
In some cases, if someone was in the room and not in a panel, I felt I had to do the whole space, even if it's not, you know.
Okay.
So, okay.
But for the inset panels, that's the image that you made.
Yeah.
You didn't go beyond that.
Yes. But you know, there's so many. I think that I'm gonna. Well, what I was saying, like this version now is available through iBooks, and it works best on the iPad because that's where you get all the interactiveness. There's a little drip coming from this ceiling over here. I'm just going to let that go. It does work on other readers because it has to. Especially in the U.S. it's only on the iPad, but here you have to have something. It has to be available on all platforms. So if you bought this in the Kindle, it would just be like flipping through the book. There's nothing interactive about it. So that's a shame that this is the way it is. But
so don't buy Kindles. We don't buy Kindles, do we?
Well, whoever.
We like books.
I mean, some people told me they were frustrated with the fact.
So does the drip turn into the end of the world with the shark above you and the water coming
no.
in?
No.
Not yet?
No, yeah. You know, actually, when I go back to New York, I'm going to be meeting with these people who do virtual reality stuff. And I thought it'd be really fun to have a version where you can actually go into the room.
Is that Oculus Rift people or other people?
I'm not at liberty to say.
You're not at liberty to say, sorry.
But there'll be, like, hopefully there'll be panels hanging in midair, and then you can just like walk right through them and just pop into the new. So anyway, it's just something I thought I should investigate. I mean, I do have other ideas that I want to get to. So it's like, I have a list of other projects.
You do?
Yes, I do. So I will get to them.
They're going to take place next door or
I hope
in
it's
the
not
kitchen?
Going to be, yeah, right. I hope it's not going to be like another 25 years before I have another book.
Well, that's great. I think we should probably, should we do some questions from the floor?
Richard, you were in Liquid, uh-huh. and you wrote the bass line to one of the, a good bass line.
Okay, thanks.
It's one of the great two-note bass lines.
It's a good song. Did you do the video to Kevin as well?
Oh, no, I didn't. We were, I mean, that was my, before I was even involved with animation at all, and we were approached by this guy, Michael Sporn, who, he just passed away last year, but he just came to the record company and said he wanted to do it, and he did it, and he got it on to, you know, I mean, it got a little airplay. But there was a moment when it was reissued, when the record was reissued in 1997 with Moax, they asked me if I had a video, and I happened to be watching this great, great animator, Oscar Fischinger, who made this animation in 1927 that, well, most of his films were abstract, and he worked a little bit with Disney on the Fantasia film. It was actually his idea to do Fantasia, and then Disney cut him out of the picture at a certain point. But he did a lot of abstract films, and his earliest film is this black and white, really trippy thing about two guys drinking, and it's just these silhouettes, but it's very, very rubbery because it's made out of clay, and he had this way of working that was, so it's just these silhouettes, and it gets just as psychedelic as you can with black and white. And I had it on my TV when I got this call, and then I was like, I called this friend of mine who's a film historian, and he said that Oscar Fischinger had passed away, but his widow was still alive, and he had her address, and I wrote her a letter, and I went out to meet her in California, and I licensed the film. And it is amazing the way it syncs up with that song. It's just like, and I've now she's passed away, and they won't let me renew the license of it. And it's her daughter that's in the way, and she just refuses. But anyway, it's a beautiful thing. I've posted it on YouTube, and it's immediately taken down. So, but there are copies of it floating around the world, and if you get a chance to see it, Oscar Fischinger, he's the man.
He's amazing. Like, but you were, and you did some animation.
I did animation much later. I did worked on two films. You can
see Fears in the Dark. Do you want to say something about?
Yeah, Fears of the Dark. You can see a little piece of it on my site, which is just my name, Richard, and then there's -Maguire.com, and there's a little piece of it there. And there's another, there's a few little animated things on there that I did.
Buy the DVD. It's a great film. Several short stories.
Fears of the
Matotti
Dark.
Did one.
It was a French produced film, and there's six different animators, and I did the last 15 minutes of that film.
I was just wondering what size you work and kind of the medium you used. It seemed to me that you mix your mediums.
Yeah,
and
well,
how you worked.
I didn't want to go back to the original way that the first version looked, because it was just done in pen and ink back in pre-digital days, Stone Age of working this way. And I didn't want to go back to it. And when I was starting to gear up for this, I was really hunting to decide how to do it. And I was doing things in various sizes. I was just experimenting, doing watercolors and paintings and gouaches and pencil drawings. And then started scanning them and sometimes recoloring them on a computer. And there's some vector art in there. But at a certain point, I decided not to. I thought they all looked great together because they felt like they all had different atmospheres and temperatures. And, you know, it looked like a scrapbook and started to make sense to me as kind of just time. Like, even in the execution of the drawings, I did some really rough sketches, and then I was kind of, and I would never ordinarily let myself show work like that. But then I was like, hey, in this context, it looks interesting because it's like, it's another time element also. And then even in the choice of palettes, I was looking at there's a lot of faded photographs that I was looking at and just loving the crazy color that happens. So I was using that as the direction. I thought, okay, even color has this time element to it. So, but I really was mixing it up. I mean, some of those images, like the mothers and babies, the paintings are big. And after, also, I was working smaller as the project went on, just so I could scan things quicker. So it's a lot of times I'm working one-to-one, exactly the same size of the book, you know.
How long did you work on it? Sorry.
I think that I did a year of research, and then maybe the last 2 years were the real crunch of working. And I had hired a guy to help me with the InDesign program, and I drove him absolutely crazy. The poor guy, it's like I put him in the book, just as but he's like, I would have my walls, and I was constantly cutting up things, and he'd come in one day a week to kind of update all my changes. And I just drove him absolutely crazy. And he quit the last 2 weeks before the project was due. He was like, I just can't take it. And he was like, no more changes. And I'm like, but that has to be done. And he just walked. And then suddenly at a party, I met somebody who actually came up to me and was like, you know, I love your work. I would love to work for you. And I'm like, thank God. It was like this like amazing like transition where the next person knew all about how to work with, because the same person had developed the images for the programmer to use. So it was somebody who's already involved with doing interactive stuff, and so it was a perfect thing. But anyway.
So your first designer wasn't the dead body in the bag in one of the images there?
He's everything's cool with him now.
Okay. Next. Hi. Quick question here about the what it actually is, what here is. I mean, to me, it looks like a comic book of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested to know if, you know, it was a deliberate attempt to kind of do something new with the medium. I mean, what I really enjoyed about my experience of reading here, the book, uh-huh. and I read the original a while ago. I saw it was in the top 100 comics in the comics journal, so I hunted it down.
Right.
Really loved it, thought it was fascinating. But I loved the kind of sense that the three-dimensionality of it. Mm-hmm. And you actually inhabit the room when you open the book.
Right.
And I wonder if that was a deliberate thing, you know, to include the reader in some sort of three-dimensional space when you hold the book open. You know, how that compares. To me, that's more powerful than the iPad edition and dropping and things. As much as that's lovely, it doesn't seem as transcendental in a way as the book.
Well,
and I just wondered if that was a conscious effort. Is it a comic, first of all? And secondly, was there a sort of sense of like wanting to do something with the comics medium that would move it on?
Well, okay, a few parts to that. First, when I did the thing originally, I had no idea I was breaking ground when I did the original idea of the multiple panels. I think that the book does definitely... I studied sculpture in school, and I was even thinking about that. I was thinking, maybe there was something to the... I mean, I don't even... I think I built a version of the room out of cardboard. And I think it was when I built it that I noticed, that I really physically noticed, thinking, oh, I could do the corner of the room in the book. But I think it took me that long to figure that out. And then the only reason I built the room, actually, was because I was trying to get the lighting correctly. And I put a light on a pole, and I videotaped the room. And I was doing this thing with the sun, like moving the sun and seeing how the light came into the space. So in the opening page where you have the end pages and you see the light coming in, I painted that from the video image that I made. But I was always trying to think of ways of, you know, getting at the same thing. But I have to say that there are advantages of the first version, having a multiple of six frames per page, because your eye can move around so quickly and you can start making associations that it's really, I mean, talking about the diagram thing that Spiegelman was talking about, it's like having a map or something. It's like there's no other medium I can think of where you can do this kind of quick creation in your head, you know? I mean, there was a film version that some students made, and it just showed me. That's where I first realized the power of comics, thinking, you know, you show this as a linear film, and it's like a window opens, it closes. It's like it just takes forever. It's not like this multiple thing where you get to choose. And so the book has its advantages for that architectural structure of the corner, which I really, when I solved that, I thought, okay, now I have to go with this because it seemed to make sense. And there was a moment where I thought about shuffling all the pages of the book so each book was going to be completely unique. And I went to the publisher about it, and they were like, you mean somebody's got to do that by hand? You know, like, who's going to do that? And so they were a little bit scared of it. And then I thought, oh, I'm being too crazy. I should let the book the book has this perfect arc. And so that's when I made the story have a beginning and an end. And I felt, let the book be the book, and then let the interactive version be the interactive version, because that's what that does best. And, you know, so I think they each have their power. And that's what I'm always, I guess that's the thing, is just to be, you know, I always like mixing it up with mediums, and I like to try to find what that medium does best and follow it through.
I always thought the great power of comics, the reason why I love comics so much, is what's not there. There isn't motion there, literally, and there isn't sound, and there isn't music, but there is all of those things in this book, but those are all happening in your head.
Right.
And so that's the conversation. You're providing...
Right.
This starting point, and then you bring so much more of the conversation to it. I think that's why the people that love comics fans, really love comics, is because they've invested so much in the telling of the story.
Right. Well, I mean, there was the publishers were saying, "Are you going to add sound or music to your?" And I just thought, it's not a reading experience. I'm trying to keep it. I mean, I didn't want it to look like a bad film. You know, it's like I just thought it should just remain. Like even the little bits of animation, the only reason I'm doing that is because I was thinking about those small moments that I really wanted to emphasize. So when you have a curtain blow through and then the curtain goes back again, it never happens again. It's just like just to make a little golden moment, you know. So it's not really about. It's like this, you know, animated gifs or gifs. I don't know how. Like someone once, I read some article that was talking about they're either the compression of cinema or the expansion of photography, the idea of having just a little tiny moment is definitely connected to memory for me.
Yes.
I mean, that feels so much closer to memory.
It's the Chris Marker moment where the eye blinks.
Exactly,
and that's
right.
All there is.
Yeah.
There's a gentleman over there being very patient, keeps putting his hands up. Do you want to ask? Yes.
Okay. I was just wondering, because you're mostly in the same point, the same place for the entire book, how did you keep yourself motivated? How do you keep sane?
Oh, my God. It was hard. There were some days I just couldn't get out of bed, and I was like, why did you think you could do this book? And it was that was the hardest thing I would say to anybody is just, I mean, the big thing is just to keep your, I don't know how to say, I mean, it just took a lot of effort just to keep the focus. That's all. I mean, I knew I had to do it, and I was even late with delivering the book. I mean, I tried the best I could, and that was every day just chipping away till I got it done. So
so you had the whole thing structured. I didn't really talk about that. You had the whole thing planned, so you knew when you were going to get, you couldn't just sort of stop. That was out done.
No, I was mixing it up until the end,
right
to the end.
Okay.
Driving everyone completely out of their minds.
But you obviously definitely had that end point.
Well, I had to feel right. It didn't feel done. And when it was done, then I was like, okay. I can live with this being out in the world, you know. But I was having other pressures because there was a museum show, and I had to make sure. So it was like I was getting it from all sides at that point.
It's a bit of a follow-up to other questions about the book. I also read here when it came out in Raw, and my memory of the book, of the story now, has to do with my battered edition, second-hand edition of Raw.
Uh-huh.
And I was very excited when I heard that it was coming out as a book, and I have to say the British edition is lovely. It's nice to touch, and the jacket. And there's this issue with the artwork that it gets obscured with the binding. When you pass the pages, there's bits of the artwork that you cannot see as you, not only when you remove the panels that you have on top,
right,
that you described before, but the fact that you actually open the book and you don't want to break the book, right?
Mm.
A friend found this frustrating, and I found it nice. I thought it was part of the, you know, codex nature of the publication that was lovely.
Right.
So I was wondering, yes, I mean, if you could, If you see that memory has also to do with the material qualities of publications or photographs, or if you think that's a thing that only old people like me will still feel attached to, the memory of paper or the memory of stuff that you could not see because it was presented in a particular platform that has been superseded. Will people think that the book is like a secondary, is this edition for those of us who don't have iPads, or is it...
It's so important. Books aren't going anywhere, you know. Books are be with us. I mean, all we need is like one solar flare and all these, everything that is digital is going to be disappeared in blink of an eye. And we still have ancient books with us. So I feel, books are sturdy.
Are you happy with the way it was published?
Yes, I'm very happy with the way it was published. And I was trying my best to keep the idea of the gutter, keep things out of the gutter. I mean, I was thoughtful of that as much as I could possibly be. So maybe it's good to have both the iPad and the remix.
This is a question, I guess, for both of you. You both work in collage and mixed media, and if I'm not dating myself too much, you both come out of the 1980s in some way. And I wasn't there at the time. Sorry.
It's okay.
Do you see any relationship between the work that you're both doing in collage and in mixed media? And is there something to do with the time, that the 1980s, that there's something particularly important about that time? I'm not sure that you see that in the same way now. I don't see many books like here coming out now.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel like it. I mean, even though it's based on something I did 25 years ago, I feel it's a totally different thing. I don't know. And also, I feel in a weird way, when I was talking about the Windows program as being the thing that tipped it off, and now I can do the iPad version, and I couldn't have done that any time in between, you know. I mean, I signed a contract to do the book in 1999, and my publisher never called me once. They were just like, he's working on it, it's okay. And there was no language at all in the original contract of, because it didn't exist. Yet. So we had to talk about all that, So maybe it just took that long to finally be able to come around to, I don't know. Do you think there's anything?
There's something interesting about that time. Most of my teachers, I don't know if you suffered the same, came out in the 60s. They were all loved pop art. They loved Richard Hamilton. They loved that sort of attitude to, collaging together elements to create memories and create different narratives within one image. So those were my teachers. They're all into semiotics and semiology.
That's interesting. I mean, among my teachers, most of my teachers at Rutgers University, they were all Fluxus members. So they were all like, conceptualists. And I know that, I was a huge fan of like Duchamp, and I think that that's probably the roots of more of where I'm coming from. It's just like not repeating what I do or trying not to. And I mean, try not to at least think of things that could be conceptually whole on their own. And
And then I think we both started working in the 80s, and the 80s was, this amazing decade moving from analog to digital, sampling.
That's true.
Digital collage, Photoshop. It was bound into everything around me. And I still draw and paint all the time, get my hands dirty, but it's absolutely in my blood. Mm. That sampling aesthetic is in my blood.
Well, somebody pointed that out to me the other day. They said, they talked about, there's a Christian, I don't know if everyone knows Christian Marclay, the artist who did a film called The Clock, which is great. It's a 24-hour film. And he cut together all these images from every single Hollywood movie, and I guess global movie, that shows an image of a clock. And the film moves in real time. So whenever there's, you'll see, it's quite an amazing thing. And if anybody gets a chance to see it, they should. I totally went nuts when I saw it. But I was thinking of that, and I was thinking of Boyhood as being this like strange thing of time. But what I was going to say is we've never had access to such a massive amount of material. Nobody could have made the clock back in whatever that was. So just the idea that we have so much input, available to us.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have these sources when I did the original. I was using,
Digital books, particularly interactive ones, are an area of real interest to me. And I think that you know, they do something completely different to a physical book. And I'm not into the argument that they're in competition with each other or one's going to kill the other one. I think that's, right. that's pointless.
Right.
But what does puzzle me a little bit is what exactly does the digital interactive book do? I think there's been so much research on what the physical book does, uh-huh. particularly, you know, comic books, and especially Scott McCloud saying that the addition of animation to a comic messes with the idea of space and time, and I feel like here is really about that.
Right.
Here, chronologically, and here, like, spatially. And whilst I don't necessarily agree with that concept of space and time, I was wondering what you felt about it as someone who's made one.
I was just excited to be able to do a remix version of my book. It seemed such a perfect medium to play with. And I never bought, I bought the iPad when I met the programmer because I was like, okay, you know, let's get to work. And I never downloaded, I mean, I've downloaded Audible books because I like to have something when I'm painting or that I can listen to. I download podcasts all the time. But, you know, for this particular story, it seemed like the perfect medium. But I don't know about adding animation to comics. I don't think it necessarily adds anything to.
But what do you think it adds, as opposed to why was it a secondary idea? I'll make a digital version now.
Well, I just like the idea of expanding the nonlinearness of it, and I like the idea that it's showing me things about the book that I didn't even know, like the new combinations. It's like there must be thousands of possibilities, you know, like. I haven't calculated it, but, you know, when you have just a normal deck of cards of 52 cards and it seems like an infinite variety of possibilities, when I think about the amount of frames there are, it's probably thousands of... And I'm still surprised at some of the connections. And when I see a really good, particularly good combination, I take a photograph of it, and I'm doing a box set of silkscreen editions of just the best of the remix version of it. So I think that's, I don't know. I mean, I always just keep thinking of permutations of how I can make this thing reinvent itself at this point. But I don't know. I don't know about the future of, the same way I don't know anything, I don't really feel I know anything about comics either. I feel like I just, you know, I'm following my own interests. And when somebody asked earlier, is it comics or not? It's like, I don't know what the hell it is. It's just like an investigation that I've wanted this. You know, I mean, it has word balloons, so I guess it's comics. But you know,
who knows?
You know that may, you know.
I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but I was wondering if you found yourself focusing by accident on a particular period, because a lot of them are sort of like you as a child and like sort of like your family and things like that. Or is it just very random? Are there like a particular kind of time frame that you're sort of going back to a lot?
Yeah, I made a chart to show the publisher to say, and at the heart of it was my family. And then there was spinning off all these possibilities of all these things, and I had all these arrows and trying to make sense of what. And it does seem to center. I mean, the home is the center. It's my parents' home. It's not really, like, I felt like I lived there, you know, until I was old enough to move out. But they lived there 50 years, so they lived there, you know, it's really their story. They show up more often than anyone else. So I guess that's really the center. I show up a couple of times. Even later, I show up arguing with my dad in the early 2000s. Yeah, so it may be just that, you know, that's the personal part. It had to center around my family.
It's kind of hard to keep it completely random.
It's not that, well, you know, I tried my best to be as, I mean, you know, in my timeline, try to keep it interesting. I mean, there's glaciers going by, and that when the whole thing about the Lenape Indians living there 11,000 years, I was reading a book. There was a really great exhibition of called Manahatta, and it was all about Manhattan and what it looked like early, and you know, when it was still before it was taken built up. And they had this one line in the book that was talking about in Greenwich Village. There's all these windy streets, but they were once footpaths in the forest. And I was like, oh, I'm going to use that. And I just had the idea of, like, you know, okay, the road was, you know, used to be a footpath, and before that it was like maybe a dried up river bank, and then that river was wider, and maybe it was. So that was the only way I could show that passage of time was that way.
Would you say something about your choice of colour and what you think the effect of that choice was on the mood and the atmosphere of that lovely book?
Ah, thanks. Well, I had, I was using faded photography as one use of the choices of the color when it's like a really odd, especially there's differences in the 1950s faded photography and the 70s faded photography because the emulsions were different. And so I was using that as a basis. But also I had a file where if I just saw color combinations that I enjoyed, I just kept dropping them in. And then when I came to coloring the pages, I would just open something randomly and just like fill color and just be experimenting all the time with. But they were just based on a lot of palettes that came from like I looked at a lot of Japanese woodblock prints, and I loved that stuff. And then there was like a real response by a lot of French artists in the turn of the century that used the limited palettes. That is another thing that really touches me, and I really was stealing from the best of them, I guess, to use their some palettes. So that's about all I can say on that.
Sorry, this isn't really a question. It's just a kind of public service announcement, I guess. I'm Rich's editor here in London at Hamish Hamilton, and I wanted to mention something that I think everyone here will be really interested in, because Richard mentioned a show, which was actually at the Morgan Library at the end of last year. And it was a really amazing show in one room, because it showed the books and the things that inspired Richard, partly in the making of this book, and the sketches, the drawings, the photographs, the workings of the book, the acrylic painting of the cover. It was a really amazing show. And with Richard's help, what we've done is put it together as a 60-page downloadable PDF you can print off from... it's part of this magazine we do called Five Dials. If you remember Five Dials, go to fivedials.com now, or after this, download it. It's 60 pages... basically about 50-plus pages of images, like a cascade, a waterfall going down, and then a text at the end by Joel Smith about the making of the book. And it's called, The Making of Here. And I think if you enjoyed this, I really recommend it, because there's some beautiful things in there that Richard has very kindly allowed us to reproduce in this way. So that's my announcement.
Thank you. Thank you, Simon. Yeah, there's some photographs at the very end of it, too, that show the original exhibition. And there's an exhibition in Paris right now.
I was just going to mention that. If you want to buy some originals, the originals are...
Yeah, but it's a real mix, because I was doing... there's some paintings I made actual size, so there's like the cover is like the size of a real window, and then I did the flip side of that with the light coming into the room. So there's real paintings. There's an edition I did of... the empty room from the original strip, and then I bought all these rubber stamps, and I was creating individual prints from each one for each one. So they were, it was kind of like another remix version of it. But there's a lot of some of the watercolors are for sale, and some of the drawings and stuff. So it's a Galerie Martel in Paris.
So that go into the future. Mm-hmm. And you showed a very sort of fun example there. The future. I just wondered. How those two were to kind of look at. Obviously, there's the aspect of looking at memory, and how much fun it was to kind of predict things, and how it affected your way of thinking.
That was the hardest part, was doing the future stuff. And the last lecture I gave in New York, there was a guy. I was like saying, "Well, I didn't want to show any dark Blade Runner future." And then the guy who wrote the screenplay was in the audience. And it was like this really embarrassing thing afterwards. But anyway, but I don't know what I can say anymore about that and the memory that I hadn't already said, but,
It was an ecological theme.
A little. Some kind of ecological. A little bit. A nod to that.
Just a quick one. What's your favourite spreads of the lot? Is there one that stands out as just like... That was just got the most satisfaction out of
the woman looking out the window with that shadow. That's one of my favorites. Mm. Yeah. Okay.
And you've mentioned a couple of things that you're thinking about. What mm-hmm. do you think you'll be here to talk to us about next?
I don't know. I have a few half-written books in my drawer that I'll get to. And I have an idea for a feature film
in
that I want to work
time.
On.
Oh, great.
So that's another thing.
Have you enjoyed working in film? That's a whole
Absolutely,
other...
Absolutely, because it seemed to be a real distilling of a combination of a lot of things that have been my interest. Uh-huh. I love everything about it.
Great.
Yeah.
And the sound, you've got sound and music to play with.
Yes.
A bigger toolbox.
Yes. It's fun working with people.
It's
nice working alone, and it's also fun working with people.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.